5421. On the
I don't want to have EPA respond. I should have asked before on the process point. Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
No, right, yeah.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May please the court, my name is Rhonda Beard. This case is about the protection of Title VII and the Title VII process. The actions that I challenge in my complaint, particularly for hostile work environment and for discrimination and retaliation, were principally committed by the agency employees most knowledgeable about EEO law, who were savvy, sophisticated enough to know how to go to the edge and avoid the more routine types of violations that the court reviews. But the acts they committed in their failure to properly exercise the agency's investigative and discipline power are no less insidious, no less violations of Title VII. There are many compelling reasons why the district court's decision should be reversed. But this is an overview, so I want to go to the record and to start in the beginning because that's very relevant to considering and deciding the claims that I raise in this case. In the beginning is the Baird arbitration issues. Those issues surround and involve some of the very same types of claims that are brought in my complaint. But in reading, Your Honors, the appellee's statements about me and the statements about me in the decision, I wanted to go back a step further and paint an accurate picture of who I am, not from my self-serving testimony, but from sworn statements by PBGC's employees. On page 44 of the record, at the bottom of the page, my peers and supervisor testified in the arbitration, and I will just summarize some of the statements about me. A pleasant worker, receptive to instructions, eager to improve my performance. I had been a high performer up to the point of the initial incidents. I was not considered overly emotional or considered irrational, and my supervisor testified that I was, in interacting with others, direct, clear, and appropriate. That's who I am. On page 116 of the arbitrator's decision, however, you understand why I'm standing before you today. Page 116 reflects the agency's comments about me after I testified in the union's case against the agency challenging its structure of its EEO arm. Finding no one else to testify, Your Honor, despite my fear, I agreed to testify on behalf of the union. And as page 116 notes, I was the only employee who stood up and testified about the fear I had of the process because of the way it was structured, and also because I was afraid of retaliation. That's what then brings us to the claims in this case. From the time I stood up in 2002 and testified, it has been open season on me at the agency. The arbitrator found retaliation, and I point you to the decision not because I expect you to agree with the arbitrator on those facts, because instead there are sworn statements and testimony in that file that's very relevant to the claims that are before you. I not only testified then, but despite my ongoing fear and the struggles I was experiencing, I represented PBGC employees in several EEO actions. From the time I did that, Your Honor, PBGC's arm, responsible and entrusted with the responsibility of exercising the agency's investigative and discipline power, ensured that I was not protected when workplace incidents occurred. And it's interesting to note that many of the workplace incidents were perpetrated by the very persons who were responsible for policing and cleaning up the environment. The agency, this it seems to just gloss over the main allegation I make regarding its workplace rules, and that is that those workplace rules provided me with terms, conditions, and privileges of my employment, and that once the employer enacted and enforced those rules, they were required under law to provide them fairly across the board and not discriminate.
Is your argument that notwithstanding the various things that have been said in cases, including the Supreme Court, about what an adverse action is, that any violation of any workplace rule, if it is based on a forbidden purpose, is automatically always a violation of the relevant statutes?
It would depend on the purpose, Your Honor, of the violation. I think the underlying reasons for the violation matters. And I am mindful that in this jurisdiction, the court requires where there is an allegation that there's a significant change in benefits, that I would have to prove that there was objectively tangible harm. And I believe in this case that there's...
Okay, so at least in it, although the workplace rules evidently allude to the tone of voice with which fellow workers address each other, you are not arguing that every violation of that rule, even if based on a forbidden purpose, constitutes a violation of the statutes.
I think it's more accurate to say, Judge Williams, that I don't think that in this case that is a non-issue, because the violations do meet the objectively tangible harm standard. You know, when I read Hishon, I don't see a separate requirement for it. Hishon was focused on the plaintiff's claim that the employer promised to fairly consider her for promotion, fairly consider. And the court ruling on that said that when the employer provides a benefit, even a benefit like that is not obligated to provide, Title VII attaches and prohibits it.
Yeah, but that was access to acceptance as a partner, right?
It so was.
Denial of that sounds pretty material, whereas it's not clear to me that you've made the case as to each of the underlying issues that were not resolved in your favor, is such an adverse action.
Well, Your Honor, it's not the underlying acts. Appreciating the court's concern about that, note that I file these claims based on the employer's response, whether it's inaction or inadequate action. It is not the underlying acts for discrimination.
Well, but because what I'm trying to get at is that it seems to me there's a way in which your argument is correct and a way in which it is not correct, and it's important to draw the line. Certainly, to the extent that the underlying offense, regardless of whether it had to do with race, gender, retaliation, or anything, to the extent that that reaches some level of significance, a discriminatory failure to remedy it would begin to sound like an adverse action. But I guess I would be skeptical of a rule that said that any failure to remedy anything that is covered in the handbook, even if it's discriminatory, amounts to an adverse action.
But I think here,
either for purposes of the substance statute or retaliation.
Here, Your Honor, the issues that we're dealing with, taking an attorney, my credibility, reputation matters in my profession, and subjecting them to a workplace where I can be called psychotic without any action taken to address it, where the very attorneys who are supposed to address it can very freely communicate to the higher-ups that I experience litigation-induced hallucinations, and there's no consequence to it, where people are going around around me to my supervisor and to colleagues and attempting to foment others to engage in the kind of actions that I complain about against me. is above and beyond the kind of minimum standard that would be required. When an agency has rules like this, Your Honor, I think the problem is that when we look at UNCAL's language, that it's not a, Title VII is not a general civility code, in this situation, it's not acting as a civility code. There's an express civility code provided by my employer. They enforce that civility code for others. They make sure that positive, productive work environment exists for others. And my argument is that they should then provide the same benefit to me. And in the sense that those types of actions...
I think you're still skipping the adverse action.
Well, here's the adverse action.
You're focusing on the discrimination. Let's assume the discrimination. But it seems clear under the cases that a discrimination with respect to an action that is too trivial to qualify as an adverse action is not enough.
The agency's failure to respond is the issue. And I want to point you to Russell versus...
I don't think you get around the issue of the significance of the underlying act by that.
Well, Your Honor, I want to point you to the court's concerns as expressed in its case law. Russell versus Principi acknowledges that the concern with this issue is whether or not the agency is acting in a manner that's mediate or interlocutory, so that the court would be speculating about what the harm would be. I think when we hear objectively tangible harm, we think more of the consequence rather than the actor. I think the court then went on to express in Douglas versus Donovan certain factors that are relevant, which is that, you know, it's relevant who is acting. And in the exercise of its police power to investigate and to correct, it is the agency acting. It's the employer acting.
Yes, I understand
and then,
that.
Are they acting...
Insofar as you're making the argument that the underlying act itself need not be an act that would give rise to a discrimination or retaliation claim, I think you're right. Because, for example, take Rochon, where we have, I mean, the act is this threat by someone who's completely independent of the, I guess, the FBI, the Department of Justice, anyway. So you're right on that. But that, I don't think, gets around the problem of the issue of the significance of the discrimination.
Well, it's whether or not it affects the term, condition, or privilege of employment. And, Your Honor, that's what the law says, and that's what Hishon says. That's what the case law in this jurisdiction says. What are terms, conditions, and privileges of my employment? Well, they don't just stem from case law and from statute. They also stem from my employer's workplace rules. This court goes into employer's workplace rules and, for example, has ruled that a bonus is loss of a term, condition, and privilege of employment. Here, the loss of a benefit that is provided to PBGC employees is an effect on the terms, conditions, and privileges of my employment. I think that's why Hishon is so relevant, and why I think it's relevant to note that Hishon is still the law of the land.
I just want to clarify what your argument is on the retaliatory hostile work environment claim. There, your claim is not only the four failures to investigate, but also the underlying EEO activity that underlies your request for it. Is that right? It's both?
Yes, Your Honor.
And unlike your other claims, this one you actually incorporate...
The underlying acts, because they're relevant to show and explain the environment. I mean, you have situations where the complaint recites not just that employees engage in this act, but there's evidence of the employer going into the workplace around me and fomenting others to engage in the act. They did it with Richard Anderson. They did it with my supervisor. Those are just the situations I'm aware of.
In the complaint, do you allege that the agency fomented the act?
Well, Your Honor, in several paragraphs, it refers to what agency officials engaged in. For example, in paragraph 51 on page 24 of the record, in January of 2009, Mr. Moreno, the head of the investigative arm of human resources, goes to my supervisor, tells her, you know, take away the official time, give her bankruptcy and ERISA work to do. And he's fomenting as he speaks to her. And her recitation is that, you know, he spit on her during this conversation, and she's never been more disrespected. That is one incident. In front of me,
that was paragraph 49.
Paragraph 51. In front of me, Your Honor, Mr. Schwartz told the union's co-counsel in a grievance to overthrow me because I give them nothing. Mr. Schwartz at that time, all he did was EEO work. That's all I ever saw him on. And he tells Mr. Anderson on paragraph 44, tells him to overthrow me and take away the union from me because I give them nothing. These are just the people who told me. There are people who I know have been incited, but who would never say it. Another paragraph on that point, Your Honor, is paragraph 52. Mr. Moreno goes into the grill, meets Mr. Anderson, somebody who works closely with me on these EEO cases, starts telling him how I'm being investigated, how I'm no good, and begins again to foment someone else who is in my close circle, someone who can again affect me. And those are, Your Honor, just the ones I'm aware of. And the point is that in this kind of environment, what else is going on when other persons associated with these officials, like the one referenced in paragraph 58, Mr. Martinez, who seems to be incited by and at least is supported by Mr. Latimer in the actions he engaged in to affect my ability to complete my work. It's that the retaliation I complain about, which I think, Your Honor, is extremely compelling, not just would dissuade any employees. I think it's relevant that just 3 years ago, the agency came to this court in Taylor versus Solis and pointed you to the importance of their rules and of employees complying with those rules. I complied with the rules. I took my complaint to the appropriate officials, and I did so immediately. I should have had the outcome they told this court would have existed if Ms. Taylor complained promptly. Instead, we have an inconsistent result in my situation at a point where the agency has a mandatory obligation and duty to act.
Let us hear from Appellee, and we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Honor.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Lowe here on behalf of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The three issues on appeal are whether Ms. Baird's claims of retaliation, discrimination, and retaliatory hostile work environment, based upon her allegations that PBGC failed to investigate or satisfactorily redress her four discrete claims of instances of insulting conduct by her coworkers over a four-year period, stated a claim for relief under Title VII. Because the allegations in the amended complaint did not plausibly suggest that the four discrete actions at issue here had any connection to her race or sex or resulted in objectively tangible harm.
But surely, if it's the case that consequential things are done adverse to her, not on a basis of race, sex, anything forbidden, any characteristic forbidden, and the employer discriminatorily fails to investigate, pursue these, that would state a claim, would it not? And if not, why not?
Well, if the question is whether there can be a situation where a failure to investigate could result in a violation of Title VII, I think it is possible to envision that sort of scenario if it resulted in objectively tangible harm or an adverse action that is cognizable under the law. But that's not the situation we have here. The factual allegations taken as true did not plausibly state that this would lead to any sort of employment action, adverse employment action.
So in the end, it's the significance or insignificance of the underlying acts, putting aside the allegedly discriminatory response to those acts on which it turns.
I think it turns on both. Certainly, if the underlying acts themselves do not evidence any sort of connection to her race or
Well, why
sex.
Is that? I mean, that isn't the case in Rochon, is it?
That's not the case in a retaliation setting.
Well, why is retaliation different? Suppose the discrimination there, discrimination, not the threat, was alleged to have been based on race, etc.
Retaliation does take a, there is a broader reading of retaliation and what is covered under retaliation.
Okay, I understand that that concept, but suppose you have death threats.
Sure.
And the employer is vigorously investigating death threats against white males and totally disregarding death threats against black females. No problem?
In the retaliation context, that
well,
would be.
Let's put aside retaliation. I'm trying to make it just pure race and sex. Why is that not cognizable?
Well, I think that then takes us to the objectively tangible harm. And if in that scenario, you could show that it had an effect, significant effect on the employee.
If the underlying, by hypothesis, non-discriminatory acts are sufficient, then the failure to address them, if it's discriminatory, can give rise to a cause of action.
I think there could be a scenario where that could be the case.
I just want to get the background principles clear.
Sure, but in this case, that's not what the factual allegations pled.
What about her reputation as an attorney?
I think reputational harm is a subjective injury that is not redressable, that's not contemplating.
Why is it subjective when an attorney is called psychotic?
I think, well, that's
it's circulated throughout her workplace.
Well, that's
what's subjective about that?
That specific allegation was made by a union official. Ms. Baird's amended complaint actually pleads that there was an investigation into the emails that were circulating. And the investigation that was conducted by Littler Mendelson concluded that all of this was not under Title VII because it was protected union activity.
Okay, so Title VII doesn't protect her when she's working as, when she's bringing cases of violations of Title VII, when she's bringing complaints before the EEO office. I just want to be clear on that because the way I read the record, the law firm just said, look, it was union activity, not covered.
Right. The unions, the law firm, the Littler Mendelson report did conclude that all of it was under the rubric of union activity, and so perhaps there could be redress.
That's a free-for-all zone?
No, there could be redress under the FLRA, other avenues through union grievance procedures, which Ms. Baird can avail herself of. This is not the statutory scheme through which she can find relief.
I want to ask a series of questions about the retaliatory hostile work environment claim, which I'm going to call an HWE claim, so I don't have to keep repeating the words. So my understanding of her complaint is, and she confirmed, is that for the hostile work environment, she's not talking about discrete acts or discrete failures. She's talking about a series of acts and a series of failures to investigate, all of which together mount up to a hostile work environment. You agree with that characterization of her complaint?
I agree that's her the argument she wishes to make.
Why isn't that what she says in her complaint?
Well, I think her complaint talks about all these incidents, but I think the question was, is there any sort of allegation in there that there's this grand orchestrated scheme by PBGC higher level officials to foment?
Well, she says
foment,
it doesn't have to be higher level officials.
Or any sort of coordination to foment.
Well, paragraph 68 says the harassment and hostile work environment, including PBG's failure to take appropriate corrective action, was so severe and pervasive that it altered the terms and conditions and created a very abusive atmosphere. And paragraph 67 says plaintiff alleges that PBGC, that is the agency, willfully, intentionally, maliciously, and or unlawfully allowed the maintenance and perpetuation of a hostile work environment where employees felt free to disseminate inflammatory, defamatory, libelous, and intimidating emails and to make unfounded, harmful allegations. And that they did this, in paragraph 69, to retaliate against her in her prior and ongoing EEO activities. Now, that's not just an individual refusal to enforce part of a, that's not a claim of an individual refusal to enforce part of a civility code. That's alleging a entire program, not only of doing bad things, but also failing to investigate or stop those bad things altogether. And why isn't that sufficient to make out a hostile work environment as a retaliation claim?
Well, I think, and if I could first address the underlying actions
yes.
themselves,
yeah.
the nature of a hostile work environment necessarily has to be different from a discrimination, all these series of discrete acts. And
well, you say they're discrete, and
well,
she says they're not. And this is 12b-6. She's had no discovery. I think if all she had were these statements at the time of summary judgment, maybe you would win. But we're talking about 12b-6 here.
It is 12b-6. And what it is at the 12b-6 stage, and what we need to do is to look at the factual allegations that she has pled, and the paragraphs that you've read that she cited to, these are not factual allegations. They're conclusions. They're legal conclusions.
Well, she states a series of facts. She states that the attorney who represents PBGC in Baird's equal employment opportunity complaints disseminated the email calling her, saying she has litigation-induced hallucinations. She says that Lattimore, who's one of her supervisors, who had been found liable for the retaliation, singled her out to sign the email about inappropriate use of resources. She says that the labor management official, Ruben Moreno, yelled at her, banged his fists on the table. She says that Moreno instructed Baird's supervisor that Baird was no longer allowed union and EEO time. She alleges that all of these were not investigated or not enforced under the code. And she alleges that she may get more, that this is all that she knows about, but if she were given discovery, she may learn of many more activities. So why isn't this good enough at the 12b-6 stage?
I think the question is whether these are all part of the same employment action.
Yes.
And her factual allegation, and we submit that they are not, because you're talking about different individuals that occurred, taking actions that occurred over a four-year period of time. The emails from the union officials, Jefferson Perry's, that was in April of 2005. Her complaints, her amended complaint says that. The Lattimore request went to not just her, it went to her and two other employees. This was an agency-wide email. It wasn't just sent to her. She wasn't singled out.
Well, she says she was singled out to sign it.
Well, she says that she and two other employees
That's three people were singled out to sign it, right?
Right, but being asked to sign a memorandum by someone in human resources, an agency-wide memorandum, just simply saying, I received this
memo. What if the evidence ultimately shows that not only that she was the only one, but that there's a notice in this guy's file that says, I'm doing this because I'm retaliating against her? Isn't that what discovery is for? She's not expected to know that right now.
Well, she's not entitled to discovery at the 12B6 stage.
Exactly, but it can't be the rule that we assume person has no discovery. Is the rule you're urging upon us that a Title VII retaliation plaintiff has to know all of the facts that they would present at trial before they file a complaint, and they have to put them all in the complaint?
No, certainly not.
That's not the rule. And it's certainly the case, as we know, that in many cases after discovery, there are some embarrassing documents in the files of the employer, right? Or maybe even of the plaintiff, either way. And so the question is whether she's entitled to get to the stage of even asking for that. And when she's made, as specific a set of complaints here as she was able to do as at the stage of the complaint, can we shut her down from any discovery just because, basically on the assumption that discovery won't get her any more? That's basically what we're doing, isn't it?
Well, I think we have to fit this in the framework of Twombly, which tells us that she cannot simply plead enough facts to be sufficient or to be consistent with liability. She must get enough to cross the line from possibility to plausibility.
Right, and this complaint is unlike the complaint in Twombly or many other cases. This is quite specific. She's listed quite a lot of facts.
Well, she...
And the only question now is it plausible that discovery will produce evidence that supports the connection between these facts or finds more facts? I don't think Twombly stands for the proposition that, or do you, I mean, you don't think it stands for the proposition that discovery, that the possibility of discovery should not be considered at the 12B6 stage, that discovery might produce more, do you?
No, I think what Twombly teaches is that the Sherman Act does not prohibit all sorts of practices, just ones that are the unreasonable restraints, just ones that are the product of unlawful agreements, right, tacit or express.
Right.
Similarly, in the Title VII context, Title VII doesn't prohibit all personnel practices,
right,
that are adverse, just in the specific to the retaliatory hostile work environment,
right,
context. Has to be ones that rise to a level of severity or pervasiveness,
right,
that is sufficient to alter the conditions of her workplace. Ms. Baird's allegations, taking them all as true, just do not plausibly state or suggest the level of severity or pervasiveness to get us to that level.
What if she had another sentence that says, based on this, I reasonably believe that there's more and I'll find it in discovery? Would that make a difference?
Well, I think then any plaintiff could simply add that.
Well, if they had, she's not adding it to nothing. She's adding it to quite a number of specific items and a series of specific complaints. And she believes that these are connected. And the only question is whether it's plausible at this stage, right? As you say, whether it's plausible. You think it's not plausible that these are connected?
I think it's a question of the quality of her allegations, not the quantity. And we have certainly a multitude of allegations here, but even considering them all together and taking them as true, as we're required to, they do not plausibly state a claim for retaliatory hostile work environment. And I just want to go back to the discrete incidents that we were talking about. In addition, we've got the April 05, the June 05 request by Latimer for her signature, and then we go to January 2007 by Ray Forster, and that was in the context who was opposite to her in an arbitration proceeding. So it's in the context of litigation that the email went out. That was in January of 2007, a year later. Then we go to her next allegation is the August 2009 behavior by Mr. Moreno, who was a witness in a deposition she was taking. And the case law teaches us that context matters, and we need to consider harassment claims, hostile work environment claims, in the context in which they arrived. Her amended complaint pleads, the factual allegations plead that these all arise, for the most part, in the context of either union disputes or litigation settings, which are, to no one's surprise, necessarily adversarial. And so that's why we think her complaint suffers from a defect and cannot get past the 12B6 stage. If the court has no further questions, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Could I ask you
a couple of
questions here about the district court's opinion?
Yes.
I guess you and Judge Williams covered my first question. My second question is, when the district court is referring to the hostile work environment claim, it cites a number of district court opinions which say, and the district court quotes them, that the plaintiff cannot easily bootstrap allegedly retaliatory incidents into a broader hostile work environment claim. Then there's some more quotes suggesting that if you have a discrimination claim and you have a retaliation claim, you can't rely on the facts underlying those claims in presenting a hostile work environment claim. Do you know of any authority other than those district court opinions for that proposition?
Well,
In other words, your discussion with Judge Garland suggests that you don't buy into that analysis. But
well,
I just wanted to be clear.
I think the key here on page 23 is the idea of cobbling together a number of distinct disparate acts. And
right, but
that's,
if the disparate acts, for example, were discrimination, were retaliation, if she can cobble those together into a pattern in practice,
well,
sufficiently, in your terms, in the Supreme Court, pervasive and severe, I'm not clear why she can't rely on that evidence.
I think we have to go back to the Supreme Court's opinion in Morgan.
That's right, which really opens the door.
Well, Morgan, I don't think Morgan opens it as widely as plaintiff would want, because Morgan does take what the lower court had done in that case and comments on the language in there about the same type of employment action occurred relatively frequently and were perpetrated by the same managers. And you have to look at whether these were the same part of the same action, same employment action.
It's under her umbrella that she has this term and condition of her employment that are the rules the employer has promulgated, and they're not being enforced.
Well, I don't think that gets us there. And again, going back to the factual allegations in the complaint, the allegations don't say that they're not being investigated. They, in fact, tell us that some of them have been investigated, just not to the plaintiff's satisfaction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. All right, Mrs. Baird, we'll give you 3 minutes. We'd like to.
Your Honor, this is why PBGC's workplace rules matter. The rules are foundational. What they provide to one employee, they provide to me. For example, they tell you that, you know, the Mendelsohn investigation washed this clean because they said it was union activity. I point you to pages 67 to 75 of the record, where the agency went into union activity, pulling out misconduct, and they corrected it. They disciplined the employees for it. I mean, the agency is making these representations, and I want to urge the court that this is the very reason why you should send me back for discovery, because these are representations being made to you attacking the complaint when the facts that exist at the agency are very different. If they're going to go into a union meeting to discipline, and they're going to come to court in a union case to pull records and go back and investigate, then they can investigate my situation. In their rules, there is no exception for adversarial conduct. In fact, the rules don't even accept behavior that occurs while you're on a lunch break. And to prove that, Your Honor, pages 67 to 69 of the record, when a labor management attorney complains about the conduct of one of the attorneys representing an employee, PBGC, they enforce the professional courtesy directive because he slammed the door and they determined his tone wasn't appropriate. They discipline and they investigate all the time. All the complaint has to do is allege sufficient facts to put the defendants on notice. And that's something I want to correct, reading the court's decision in Actas Health Quebec, that is still the fundamental.
In which opinion?
Actas Health Quebec. I may be pronouncing it incorrectly.
What's the site, just so I know?
The site on the standard is 525 F3rd 8. And this court says that Twombly leaves.
Some people refer to it by the other party.
Oh, or Fain Jeans. Much easier. Fain Jeans Incorporated, where the court said it's still the fundamentals of notice pleading. I feel like I'm being put to a summary judgment test here. And the question is, these retaliatory acts, could they dissuade? They certainly could. Making sure an employee is so uncomfortable that I know that I will be subjected to this kind of treatment in the workplace without correction and conduct if an investigation is conducted, because it won't always conducted. If an investigation is conducted at all, it would be inadequate and would be conducted months after the complaint is made. That's unacceptable. Their rules, a prompt investigation is not 6 months after the complaint. Something else I want to point you to, Your Honors. In the complaint, I state about 20 acts. The underlying acts many times state that they're retaliation. There's a distinction between not challenging the act as actionable and the complaint saying that there's no discrimination. And I want to make sure the court understands, I'm not saying that those underlying acts aren't themselves violations. I'm saying that the court wouldn't have found them actionable, so I didn't file charges on them. But when you read them out, you will often see that my concern was for retaliation and for the agency, in fact, continuing the fomenting. For example, the memo when Mr. Latimer wanted me to sign, my complaint wasn't just the signing. It was that they provided false information to my supervisor, telling him that I was distributing material in the workplace, yet they hadn't asked me if I had done so, and frankly, I had not. That kind of conduct could foment my supervisor to come after me with a disciplinary action. The agency was reckless and intentionally reckless in continuing this pattern of conduct. I count in the complaint 20 underlying acts and agency failure to act and to act in accordance with its rules, and that's just 20. In several areas, I told you there were others without explaining in detail what they were. I made numerous complaints to the agency. You know, it didn't take 8 years in the military to learn what they taught me the first day. Chain of command, follow my chain of command. The party responsible for enforcing the rules is the agency. I didn't bring them to court when the incidents occurred. I brought them to court when they failed to act as they act for other employees. And since the agency is representing its constraints on acting, I really do want you to take a look at pages 67 to 75 and see how they go into union activity and see how they discipline their employees wherever that conduct arises, which is in compliance with their professional courtesy directive that does not exempt an employee once you're on PBGC's time. Once they're paying you, even if you're on your lunch break, there is no exception to the rules reach. Another fact I want to point the court to is in addressing the types of conduct, I couldn't find a case like this in a jurisdiction where what the agency is doing is continually attacking my mental state, even the litigation-induced hallucination. What is a hallucination other than another form of psychosis? By the very individuals who are supposed to police the workplace. And I always go back to how comfortable that attorney felt putting his chain on an email like that and then having it broadly disseminated. It's in the record at page 38, and page 41 is my complaint about it, that I come to them and I say, listen, this is absolutely wrong for so many reasons. They never take action to address that one. Not even the widespread dissemination of that kind of verbiage about me, making sure employees understand who and what I am in the workplace. You know, Burlington Northern says this, you know, the common sense says one way to ensure an employee doesn't participate is to commit the acts in that case. Well, common sense says that if an employee knows they're going to be subject to this kind of treatment and these kinds of claims being made against them in the workplace, that they will sit down and shut up. And that's what too often happens. Because I continue to press forward, John, it doesn't mean that my agency gets to subject me to this kind of treatment. Their names are so important. I want you to note, in the arbitrator's decision, their names are concealed by their express request because their reputations matter as attorney. If their names are so important that they don't want to impugn themselves when they're found liable, what about my name when I haven't committed an infraction? You know, I've seen myself being continually attacked in their pleadings. They choose to defend themselves by coming after me, and I go back to page 44 about who I am. Because I stand up, because I speak out, doesn't mean that I get to be a victim. That's what Title VII is meant to protect, and that's what you get to do. You get to decide, Your Honors, is this sufficient to go to discovery? It's not summary judgment, it's just to go to discovery, to determine how many other emails exist in the workplace, and to determine why Mr. Latimer's subordinates continually seem to feel free to come after me. This kind of inciting in the workplace would take any employee low, and it did lay me low. I don't think objectively tangible harm even bars my discrimination claim. I think the fact that these are not immediate interlocutory actions, that an investigation and disciplinary action decisions are not made in a discretionary manner, as PDGC argues on page 28. They are made subject to objective rules, and those rules are found in not just their rules, but also Title VII. I want to urge the court, if you're going to rule against me, to do so in a manner that helps me understand how my employer could have rules they enforce for white employees, for male employees, and how my employer could subject me to this kind of environment and escape liability, particularly when we're aware about who they are, who the perpetrators are. But more importantly, if you agree with me, I ask that you issue a decision that makes it clear to any employer or any employer representative that Title VII is indeed flexible enough to address and redress the kinds of conduct that exists in this claim, because you're not seeing employers hang nooses and call people Negroes or nigger or call me girl or chick in the workplace. That's not what's happening now. Because they have evolved in the types of actions they're taking, the law doesn't have to evolve. The law is clear. It's the terms, conditions, and privileges of my employment that matter. And I respectfully ask the court that that is what you find and that you send me back for discovery.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I've got an argument tomorrow, 15 minutes. Can I reserve any amount of time I want, or
when you come into the courtroom tomorrow at 9 a.m., you come to that desk and you tell me how much time you want for rebuttal.
Okay.
Then after we get started, you come up and to argue. You can either let the court know that you've reserved time, or as you've seen today, some attorneys just want to get started with the argument. That's entirely up to you.
All right, secondly, when does a warning light come on?
It depends on how much time you've reserved.
Okay, let's say I reserved 3 minutes, and I've got a 12-minute argument.
You have a 15-minute argument.
I know, well, but I've reserved three.
Right, out of your 15 minutes. Right, you have 12 minutes of principal argument time.
Right. So when does the yellow light come on?
At 3 minutes.
At 3 minutes?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, and if on the 3 minutes, does it come in 1 minute, or?
No, but it comes on at 3 minutes. The yellow light will come on for you at 3 minutes.
Okay. Now, can you give me the list of the names of the parties here today and the parties tomorrow?
Give me a moment and have a seat in the audience. I have to attend to my judges.
Sure.